Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 14th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local headlines from Fort Dodge. Our first headline today reads, Angels of Love, Fundraiser Returns to Trinity. Over the last 23 years, the Trinity Regional Medical Center Auxiliary Volunteer Organization has raised more than $185,000 for smaller peripheral purchases for different hospital departments that may not fit in the hospital's annual budget. Those funds have been raised through the organization's Angels of Love fundraiser, which is happening now. First started in 2001, the Trinity Gift Shop at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center has sold special angel ornaments for donors to honor or memorialize loved ones. The angel ornaments, a new design each year, are available for purchase with a $15 minimum donation. The purchase can be made in memory of or in honor of a loved one. There will be a display board in the Trinity Regional Medical Center atrium lobby where the honorees' names will be listed alphabetically by donor's last name. The hospital budget really focuses on bigger ticket items that can make a big difference, and the items Angels of Love funds are sometimes considered fluff. Nadine Schlentz, chair of the Friends of Unity Point Health TRMC committee, told the Messenger during last year's fundraiser. They are still very important in the patient care aspect, and we can help to support that. This year, she said, the funds raised will be used to purchase outerwear for the guest services volunteers so they can stay warm throughout the winter as they help hospital patients and visitors into the building. We felt that people in the community really appreciate that service, Schlenz said. The hospital doesn't offer valet services anymore, but it did recently launch an electric shuttle vehicle for visitors who need assistance getting from their vehicle in the parking lot to the building's entrance. And the new outerwear will help keep the guest services volunteers warm as they shuttle visitors and patients back and forth. The shuttle vehicle was purchased by Friends of Unity Point Health TRMC. We have so many elderly or disabled people that really struggle with getting into the hospital, Schlenz said. Last year, the funds from the 22nd annual Angels of Love were used to purchase two new infusion chairs for the infusion center, which serves patients who receive IV medications such as antibiotics, chemotherapy, pain management, hydration, or nutritional supplements. Angels of Love also helped give a refresh of the patient and visitor waiting area and cardiology services. Other previous purchases funded by Angels of Love include 10 new wheelchairs, an upgraded linear accelerator for the cancer center, a bariatric bed, support of valet services, and more. While the auxiliary orders about 1,000 angels each year and the minimum donation is $15, many donors give much more money, while some give money but decline taking an angel. There is no limit to how many angels an individual can purchase. We start getting calls in early October, said Connie Springer, volunteer coordinator. It's been very well supported by the community, she said. Trinity Gift Shop hours are 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturdays and are closed on Sundays. Angels can be purchased and picked up at Trinity Gifts, or for a small shipping fee, the ornaments can be mailed. For more information on the Angels of Love, call 515-574-6656. Our next headline for local news reads, Planning Underway for 2024 Street Work, Downtown Alley Project Introduced. The 2023 road construction season is pretty much finished, and engineers are already planning projects for next year in Fort Dodge. Design work for 2024 projects has started, Chad Schaefer, the city's chief development officer, told the city council Monday evening. He said those upcoming projects will build on the progress made since 2008. Since that year, 40% of the city's streets have been improved by complete reconstruction, asphalt paving, or extensive concrete patchwork, he told the council. He estimated that an average of $4 million a year has been spent on infrastructure for the past 15 years. A lot of money has been spent, he said. These are projects currently underway in the city. Construction of an office, lab, and odor control facility at the wastewater treatment plant. Construction of a trail between Fort Dodge and Badger. Infrastructure work related to the Corridor Plaza development. Construction of pickleball courts at Schmoker Family Park on North 32nd Street. Construction of a skateboard park at the former Sunkissed Meadows Golf Course. Current plans call for repaving sections of 12 streets next year. Schaefer told the council that he has received a draft agreement with the Union Pacific Railroad for the replacement of the bridge that carries Highland Park Avenue over the tracks. He said the city staff will be talking to railroad representatives about some changes to that agreement. A new bridge for that location is currently being designed. Another major project currently being designed is a water main that will extend from the Ag Industrial Park west of Fort Dodge, called Iowa's Crossroads of Global Innovation, to Manson. The main will be used to supply water from Fort Dodge to Manson. Engineers had previously estimated that construction of that water main could begin next year. Another project the council learned about on Monday would spruce up a downtown alley and possibly make it a destination for special events. The alley runs east-west behind the buildings on the north side of Central Avenue, between 9th and 12th Streets. A plan produced by Snyder and Associates of Ankeny for Main Street Fort Dodge shows landscaping at each place where the alley intersects with a street, murals, lighting, parking for food trucks, and a kind of hanging structure shaped like a glider suspended over part of the alley. The project is estimated to cost $2.2 to $2.8 million. At the present time, Main Street is not asking council to allocate financial resources, just staff or council time to help guide the project, said Sharon Stroh, executive director of Main Street Fort Dodge. The council took no action on the proposal Monday. Our next headline reads, Bank Failure Surprises Sac City. New owner has reopened the institution, and the dateline is Sac City. The first Iowa bank failure in a dozen years took place in the county seat of Sac County in early November. But a succeeding bank took over the bank's assets, and it has reopened. The fact that the bank quickly changed hands and is open for business has made Sac City residents more at ease with what happened, Mayor Scott Bunt said Monday. It caught everybody off guard, he said. A recent review of Citizens Bank in Sac City turned up loan losses that previous audits had not detected, the Iowa Division of Banking announced in a release. Therefore, the state's superintendent of banking declared it insolvent and closed Citizens Bank and tendered the receivership to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the government entity that insures qualified bank deposits of up to $250,000. Iowa Trust and Savings Bank of Emmitsburg purchased the bank and on November 6th reopened the Sac City office as a branch office. It seemed to be seamless, Bunt said, adding that it was only natural that some people had some unease about the change. Citizens Bank was the first Iowa bank to be closed since 2011. The bank had a concentration of non-regional loans to one industry and experienced heavy losses on some of those loans. Citizens Bank was established in 1929 and had a main office and drive-up facility. As of its third quarter call report, Citizens Bank reported $65.6 million in total assets and $58.9 million in total deposits, according to the banking division. There are three banks in Sac City, a town of 2,040 people. Brianna Snyder, a Sac City Main Street board member, said the Citizens Bank failure was surprising, but people are taking the news in stride because of the rapidly announced purchase by the Emmitsburg Bank. "We are relieved," Snyder said. For customers of the former Citizens Bank who have questions, the FDIC has established a toll-free number at 866-314-1744. Our next headline reads, Fort Dodge Bridge named in Habhab's honor. The always busy bridge on First Avenue South got much-needed repairs during a recently completed 8-month-long project. It now has a new name as well. Known for about 55 years as Veterans Bridge, it is now the Albert Habhab Veterans Memorial Bridge. It is named after a World War II veteran who was the city's mayor when the span was built. Habhab was a mayor, district court judge, and judge of the Iowa Court of Appeals. The new name of the bridge was announced during Friday's veterans ceremony at St. Edmund Catholic School. Habhab, who was present, received a standing ovation. On Monday, the city council voted unanimously to rename the bridge. The council resolution states, whereas Albert Habhab was born September 6, 1925, in Fort Dodge, and whereas after graduating early from Fort Dodge Senior High, he enlisted into the Army on January 25, 1944. 9 months later, his unit, the 87th Infantry Division, fought in the Battle of the Bulge. As a result of his Army service, Habhab was awarded the Bronze Star, 3 Battle Stars, and the Combat Infantryman Badge. Whereas Albert Habhab served as the mayor of Fort Dodge from 1960 to 1974. During his tenure, he made significant improvements to address the frequent flooding caused by the Des Moines River. He is also credited with the construction of Williams Drive and Veterans Bridge, which have played a vital role in the development of the city. And, whereas in 1975, he was appointed as a judge in the 2nd Judicial District, where he served for 13 years. Later, in 1988, Habhab was appointed to the Iowa Court of Appeals and was eventually chosen as its chief judge by his fellow judges. After leaving the court in 1997, he continued to serve as a senior judge for 8 more years, and whereas the son of Lebanese immigrants and Fort Dodge native, he has devoted his life to service as an Army private in World War II, as the city's mayor for 14 years, and as a district court judge and state appellate court justice. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the City Council hereby renames the Veterans Memorial Bridge to the Albert Habhab Veterans Memorial Bridge in honor of Albert Habhab's accomplishments, contributions to our community, and dedication to humankind. And now turning to local obituaries. First, we remember Mary Etta Baxter. Services will be at 11 a.m. Friday at the United Methodist Church in Mallard, with a visitation starting at 9:30 a.m. Lynn's Funeral Home is serving the family. Next, we remember Geraldine Close. Geraldine Close passed away at the Arbor Springs community in West Des Moines on October 30th after a long illness. She lived most of her life in Renwick, close to friends and family. She was 79 years old. A celebration of Geraldine's life will be held in the spring. To leave an online tribute, visit oakcrestfuneralservices.com. Next, we remember Daryl Gommels. Daryl Gommels, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with the Lord on November the 11th. He passed away at home, surrounded by his loved ones. A visitation will be held at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home on Wilson Avenue from 5 to 8 p.m. on November 17th. Memorial services will be 9:30 a.m. November 18th at Zion Lutheran Church in Hiawatha. Reverend Kevin Zellers will be officiating. Burial will be at 3 p.m. that day at Rose Hill Cemetery in Manson. Cards may be sent to the family in care of Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home, located at 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Next, we remember Larry Nelson. Services will be 11 a.m. on Saturday for Larry Nelson, age 79, of Lakeview, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Wall Lake. Visitation will be Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Next, we remember Valin Wilcox. Services for Valin will be held 1:30 p.m. Friday, November 17th at the Gunderson Funeral Home. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior. And now turning to local sports headlines. This one reads, The Big Stage. Triton volleyball team heads to their home away from home. And the dateline is Cedar Rapids. Iowa Central's volleyball program has made the Alliant Energy Powerhouse Arena and NJCAA Division II championships their home away from home. For a fourth consecutive season, the Tritons will compete with the best of the best here, beginning Wednesday, when they take on Pensacola State College at 1 p.m. Iowa Central, who's 31-5 overall, survived a regional tournament that included two other ranked teams after sharing the ICCAC regular season title with both Des Moines area and Kirkwood. Both DMAC and the Eagles earned wild card bids to nationals. Coupled with a schedule featuring numerous rated foes, the Tritons earned their third straight season of at least 30 wins. Over the past four seasons, Iowa Central has gone 131-19, placing 7th, 4th, and a program best 3rd at nationals during that stretch. This version needed to replace several key ingredients from the past, as sophomores Maya McLean, Mercedes Matlock, Alex Hiracheta, Naomi Chichaccio, and Emma Bilheimer have led the way. McLean, a former St. Edmund standout, has started all 36 matches, recording 624 digs with 119 assists and 59 aces. She has 100 aces in her two-year career after seeing action in 32 matches as a freshman. Chichaccio has a team-high 478 kills to go along with 388 digs and 104 aces. Former Manson Northwest Webster standout and freshman Olivia Sturgis is second with 264 kills, while Bilheimer has 249, and another ex-Cougar, Emily Goodner, has 238. Matlock leads the team with 1,280 assists to go with 417 digs and 96 kills, while Hiracheta, a Fort Dodge senior high grad, has 287 digs and 54 aces. Sturgis, McLean, and Matlock made the All-Region 11 tournament team, with Sturgis garnering MVP honors. Our next local sports headline reads, Fort Dodge girls open new wrestling season. The dateline is Grimes. It will be a busy first week for the Fort Dodge girls wrestling team, as they compete four times in a seven-day stretch beginning here on Tuesday. In the second year of sanctioned wrestling under the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union, the Dodgers head to Dallas Center Grimes for a double duel with Waverly Shellrock and the Mustangs. Fort Dodge will compete against the Go Hawks at 5:30 p.m. Junior varsity action will be next, followed by a matchup with Dallas Center Grimes. The Dodgers had four state qualifiers in 2022-2023. Gone is state runner-up Alexis Ross. Senior Macy Brown and Maddie Pullis, along with sophomore Mariah Benedict, are fighting to get back to the big stage. Brown, in her first season of wrestling, compiled a 19-17 record a year ago. Pullis was 18-8 and was a super regional champion, along with earning a bronze medal at the Don Gable Donnybrook. Benedict finished 29-16. The Dodgers have 11 varsity wrestlers in all this season. Our next local sports headline reads, Iowa Central men place in top 10. The dateline is Huntsville, Alabama. The Iowa Central men's cross-country team secured a top 10 finish here Saturday at the NJCAA Division I Championships. Trinidad State was first, followed by Salt Lake and Colby. Salt Lake freshman Jaquavius Harris won the individual title by 5 seconds over Tomas Vega of New Mexico. Leading the way for the Tritons was Hussam Harabi, as the sophomore clocked a time of 24:12.8 to finish 11th overall. Jed Elmbarki was 34th. Hamza Mohammed finished 41st. Jaden Boots was 51st. Joseph Ashai Wright placed 80th. And Andrew Boyum was 83rd. And Seth Cheney finished 95th. Both Harabi and Elmbarki were recovering from injuries suffered during the previous year, with this marking just their third race of the season. Iowa Western's Sylvia Gradizzi was the Division I women's champion, with Salt Lake claiming team gold. Lansing in the men and Cowley in the women won the Division II titles, with Harper sweeping the trophies in Division III. This was the first time since 2020 that all three NJCAA divisions held their championships at the same site. Up next will be the NJCAA Half Marathon Championships back here on Tuesday. And now turning to some national news headlines, we have this one. High-ranking Mormon leader M. Russell Ballard dies at age 95. He was second in line to lead the faith, and the dateline is Salt Lake City. One of the highest-ranking leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, M. Russell Ballard, has died. He was 95. He died Sunday, surrounded by family at his home, according to a church statement Monday morning. Ballard was second in line to become church president based on being the second longest tenured member of a top governing body called the Quorum of 12 Disciples, which he said he was called to join in 1985. The leadership body sits below the first presidency and helps set church policy and oversees the faith's business interests. Ballard was a great-grandson of Hiram Smith, brother of church founder Joseph Smith. Beginning as a young missionary in England, he rose through church leadership ranks, becoming a bishop, president of the Toronto Mission, and member of the presidency of the 70. Speaking at a church conference last April, Ballard said the most valuable things in life are those that last the longest, including family relationships, which he realized when visiting the victims of natural disasters. M. Russell Ballard was born in Salt Lake City in 1928 to Melvin R. and Geraldine Smith Ballard. His wife Barbara died in 2018. Funeral arrangements are pending. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe-Gazette for Tuesday, November 14th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. Our first headline reads, Asa Hutchison to visit Clear Lake. Former Arkansas governor and 2024 Republican presidential candidate Asa Hutchison will stop at Cabin Coffee in Clear Lake Thursday for a meet-and-greet event, according to a press release. Hutchison, who served as the 46th governor of Arkansas from 2015 to 2023, will make 4 stops in Iowa this week, greeting potential caucus goers in Ames, Grinnell, and Decorah, in addition to the Clear Lake event, scheduled to take place from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 16th at Cabin Coffee Company, located at 303 Main Avenue in Clear Lake. As previously reported by the Associated Press, Hutchison participated in the first GOP debate, but failed to qualify for the second. He said in a statement after missing out on the second debate that his goal was to increase his polling numbers to 4% in an early state before Thanksgiving. If that goal is met, then I remain competitive and in contention for either caucus day or primary day, Hutchison wrote back in September. Earning Governor Reynolds' endorsement this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, along with former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, seem to be the candidates most poised to offer competition for Donald Trump, who remains ahead in almost every national poll in the GOP field and commands a 27% lead in Iowa. A late October Des Moines Register NBC News Mediacom Iowa poll shows Hutchison is currently polling from 0 to 1% in Iowa, with Haley even with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for a distant second place behind former President Trump among likely Iowa Republican caucus goers. Our next local story has a headline that reads, "Partnership to Hoist Up Local Child Care Wages Announced." Local child care workers could soon see a boost to their weekly paychecks. Thanks to a partnership between local businesses, the Mason City Chamber of Commerce, local municipalities, and matching state funds, almost $1 million has been raised to boost workers' wages by $2 per hour. The plan, dubbed Child Care Works, will begin upping wages at 10 child care centers in the county January 1st. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson was in Mason City on Friday, November 10th, to learn more about the project from Colleen Frein, Mason City Chamber of Commerce President, Kelly Gertis, Cerro Gordo County Population Health Division Manager, and Kathy Lloyd, longtime child care provider. "This is clearly an economic development issue," Hinson said. "It costs businesses much less to do this than to lose and then have to retrain an employee." Frein said she and others had about a two-week window in September to raise money from the businesses. They were successful in bringing $323,000, which they found out Thursday would be matched at a 2-to-1 rate by a grant from the state. "We've been really blessed by our businesses stepping up right away," Frein said. "It was a really tight turnaround we got from the state." Frein said it was one of about a dozen pilot programs to help ensure affordable and available health care around the state. "I know for myself there's a tinge of nervousness. This is what we think isn't going to fix the problem, but it's a temporary solution," Frein said. "We still have to see if people will show up to work." Frein said the extra $2 would raise the average starting wage for a child care provider from a countywide average of $9.51. The overall average wage is $11.81 per hour. Gertis hopes the extra money will be an incentive for people to fill positions that have been open this fall. Child Care Works was modeled after programs already in place in Johnson and Hamilton counties. The local program was launched in September and is still securing additional investments. After the wage supplement program is enacted in January, a July survey of providers to assess the impact will take place, and again in December to measure results. The money will be given directly from the Child Care Works program to participating centers after they provide pay stubs. As of now, private at-home child care providers are not part of the project. Gertis said they hope to secure about 50 spots for children that local centers have space for, but not enough care providers to accept new clients. All local centers report staff shortages, and only 44% of centers have space available for new clients. 1 in 4 local businesses report a loss of 10 or more employees because of childcare issues, according to a 2021 Child Care Resource and Referral Survey. Our next headline reads, Mason City Woman Pleads Guilty to Lesser Drug Charges. A Mason City woman facing up to 30 years in prison pleaded guilty to lesser charges Monday. According to court records, 36-year-old Kenyana Sanina Garrett has pleaded guilty to first offense possession of methamphetamine and first offense possession of marijuana, both serious misdemeanors. Garrett was originally charged with two felony counts of controlled substance violations in October, after being accused of possessing 37.7 grams of methamphetamine and 31.6 grams of marijuana, along with several scales and small clear plastic baggies. The methamphetamine charge is a Class B felony, and the marijuana charge is a Class D felony. The plea agreement calls for a total of 30 days in jail and a $430 fine. The affidavits state that officers were dispatched to a residence in the 300 block of First Street Southwest in Mason City around 1 a.m. on February 13th after a report of disorderly conduct was called in to dispatch. Officers allegedly located the drugs and obtained a search warrant. An order to issue a warrant for Garrett's arrest was issued on October 9th. She was booked into the Cerro Gordo County Jail on October 9th. A sentencing hearing has not been scheduled as of Monday morning. The court is under no obligation to follow the plea agreement's recommendation. Our next headline reads, Weather smiles on Iowa as harvest is completed. The dateline is Des Moines. Warm, dry weather prevailed across a majority of Iowa, resulting in 6.7 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Fieldwork included harvesting corn and soybeans, completing fall tillage, applying fall fertilizer, baling stalks, and hauling manure. The unseasonably warm and dry weather this past week offered Iowa farmers another suitable stretch to finish up harvest and tackle other farm work, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig. We expect warmer temperatures to hang around this week, though forecasts show a more active storm track as we approach Thanksgiving, he said. Topsoil moisture condition rated 17% very short, 41% short, 41% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture condition rated 27% very short, 42% short, 30% adequate, and 1% surplus. Corn harvested for grain reached 94% statewide, on pace with last year, but 10 days ahead of the five-year average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain remains steady at 16%. Soybean harvest is nearly complete, on pace with last year, and 9 days ahead of the average. Cattle continued to graze on stock fields this week, while livestock producers still had concerns about water supplies. Unseasonably warm temperatures were observed across the upper Midwest over the reporting period, according to Justin Glissan, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Positive departures approached 10 degrees in western Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 45 degrees, 7 degrees above normal. Precipitation was also lacking across the state, with stations in eastern Iowa registering measurable but below normal totals. Weekly precipitation totals range from no accumulation at most Iowa stations to 0.2 inches in Clinton. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 0.01 inch, while the normal is 0.45 inch. Several southern stations reported the week's high temperature of 72 degrees on the 6th, on average 19 degrees above normal. Mapleton in Monona County reported the week's low temperature of 17 degrees on the 10th, 9 degrees below normal. And now turning to local obituaries. First, we remember Richard Bamrick. Richard Bamrick, son of Bridget and James Bamrick, died peacefully at the age of 95 on October 21st. A rosary will be held at Lubin's Mortuary in Long Beach, California on November 17th at 7 p.m. A funeral mass will be held at St. Cornelius Church on November 18th at noon. Burial will be private on Monday, November 20th at All Souls Cemetery. Next, we remember Donna M. Buckley. Donna M. Buckley, age 92, died peacefully Thursday, November 9th at Mercy One Medical Center in Mason City, holding her daughter Jane's hand. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 14th, today, at St. Patrick Catholic Church, located at 1001 9th Avenue South in Clear Lake, with Reverend Josh Link officiating. Burial will take place in Clear Lake Cemetery. Next, we remember Kenneth Lester Moss. Kenneth Lester Moss, age 88, of Dyersville, passed away peacefully, surrounded by his family on Thursday, November 9th, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, November 17th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Military honors will follow the mass outside the church. Interment will be held at Elmwood Cemetery in Mason City at a later date. A celebration of life will be held following the Mass at the Dyersville Social Center, located at 625 3rd Avenue Southeast in Dyersville from 1 to 5 p.m. on Friday for food and continued memories of Kenneth. Next, we remember Thomas E. Waldschmidt. Thomas E. Waldschmidt, age 69, of Mason City, died Saturday, November the 11th, at his home. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 18th, at Epiphany Parish Holy Family. Officiating will be the Reverend Neil Matternacht. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. at Fullerton Funeral Home. A parish wake will be held at 5 p.m. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to three letters today. Her first one has a headline that reads, "Mom's abrupt shift leaves kids scratching their heads." They write, "Dear Abby, one night about 6 months ago, my mom walked out on my dad. A week later, she admitted she had been having an affair for a whole year. My parents' divorce was final 3 months after she left. Mom has now announced to me and my siblings that she's engaged and plans to marry her fiancé just 6 months after the divorce. We think it's a terrible idea. We really dislike her fiancé and think he's a bad guy, based on our interactions with him. Mom claims to be happy, but we don't believe her. Should we just let her live her life? How do we accept this new reality?" And it's signed Throne in Washington. And Abby replies, "Dear Throne, if you and your siblings plan to maintain a relationship with your mother, handle this like the hot potato it is. Recognize that things were not as rosy as you assumed in your parents' marriage. Take things one step at a time and make an extra effort to look out for your father. Then cross your fingers and hope that as painful as this disruption is, everything works out for the best." Abby's second letter has a headline that reads, "Marriage is on shaky financial ground." They write, "Dear Abby, I have been married 33 years. We have no savings. We live paycheck to paycheck. My husband keeps borrowing more and more, and our credit cards are out of hand. He still works. I am retired. He has a 28-foot enclosed trailer stuffed with mechanical items, hobbies, collectibles, and who knows what else, as well as a double garage filled with so much you can't walk in. There is $10,000 to $15,000 worth of stuff. He refuses to sell anything, even though he hasn't been to the trailer in more than a year. We have terrible fights over this. I'm losing sleep over our future. Any ideas?" And it's signed Going Downhill in California. And Abby responds, dear going downhill. From what you have described, your husband is a hoarder. Some people do this because of anxiety or depression. Your husband needs to get to the root of why he spends compulsively on things he isn't using. His doctor could refer him for counseling and possibly medication that would help if he is willing. However, if he's unwilling, you may need to separate your finances from him before he encumbers you both further. And Abby's final letter today has a headline that reads, Aging Parent Ready to Hand Off Holidays. They write, Dear Abby, how do you tell your adult children it's time for them to start planning family events? Neither of my 30-something kids has planned a thing. I thought I raised them better than this, but unless I plan birthdays, holidays, and etc., nothing happens. I'm tired of being the social glue. How do I get them to step up? And it's signed Passing the Torch. And Abby replies, Dear Passing, you can encourage your children to step forward and assume some responsibility for family events by telling them in plain English. As the next holiday draws near, approach them individually and as a group, and inform them that if they want family celebrations, they should start planning some of them, because after all these years, you need a break. And being as there's no local sports news today, we'll turn to statewide headlines. This one reads, Trump supporters split in reaction to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' endorsement of opponent DeSantis. The dateline is Des Moines. Donald Trump supporters in Iowa have a mix of reactions to Governor Kim Reynolds' endorsement of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in his bid for the GOP presidential nomination. Supporters of Trump, who remains the Republican presidential frontrunner in Iowa, according to polling, said Reynolds' decision to endorse did not affect their support of the former president, but some said it affected their view of Reynolds, who is popular among Iowa Republicans. Explaining the reasons for her endorsement, Reynolds said in a media interview on November 6th that she did not believe Trump could win the general election. She also praised DeSantis's leadership and effectiveness as an executive, promising that he would lead on conservative principles and not be distracted. Ron is focused, he is principled, he is results-driven, and, in short, what I love most about Ron is he gets things done, she said. Trump garnered 43% of the support of likely Republican caucus-goers in a recent Des Moines Register NBC News MediaCom Iowa poll. DeSantis registered 16%, tying for second place with former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The poll included South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott, who has since dropped out of the race. Paul Dykstra, a resident of Kellerton and state house candidate in 2022, said the endorsement did not change his opinions on Trump or Reynolds. Governor Reynolds has been a good governor, he said. She had to make a lot of tough decisions in the last 3 years. All I tell anybody who gets critical of anybody, walk a mile in their shoes and what would you do? Dykstra said he was confident the party leaders would be able to come back together after the primary and leave any disagreements in the past. Nothing is really decided until the caucus here in Iowa, and that's when we, as a state, got to come together and support the one that is selected, he said. But others said they are disappointed in Reynolds for endorsing an opponent of the former president. Trump criticized Reynolds in July for, at the time, remaining neutral in the caucuses and not endorsing him. He again lashed out at Reynolds on Truth Social after news broke that she would endorse DeSantis. He called the decision, quote, the end of her political career. Laura Ardsmore, a farmer from Harrison County, said she thought Reynolds made the wrong decision, and it made her question her support for the governor. Reynolds has done a few things I'm not happy with, but all in all, she seemed to be pretty good, she said. But this kind of tipped me the other direction. I went, wow, I can't believe she just did that. She said Reynolds' endorsement of DeSantis made her more confident in her support of Trump. The same is true for Mike Bixler, a Cedar County supervisor who has thrown his support behind Trump. Bixler said he was very disappointed that Reynolds endorsed DeSantis. Repeating an argument Trump has made, Bixler said Trump helped Reynolds become governor by tapping former Governor Terry Branstad as ambassador to China, which led to then Lieutenant Governor Reynolds assuming the role. "I just think her loyalty should be with Donald Trump, no matter what, whether she wants to come out and say it or not," Bixler said. "But especially to back DeSantis so far back in the poll, I think is politically suicidal." While Bixler said Reynolds will still remain a popular governor, he said he was going to step back and take a look at his support for her. "If you look at Trump's rallies and the support and trying to keep Iowa first in the caucuses and all the money that Trump has brought in with his rallies, I'm just very surprised that she would even take a chance for or against coming out public," he said. At the Des Moines rally, where Reynolds announced her endorsement for DeSantis, he predicted she may attract some criticism, commending her for backing his candidacy. "I appreciate Governor Reynolds getting involved in the process," DeSantis said of the endorsement. "Now, look, when you do that, some people don't like it, and some people say this or that. But I think that she understands what I understand, which is this country has hit the skids. This country is in a period of decline." Gary Loeffler, a member of the Polk County Central Committee and former primary candidate for Iowa's 3rd Congressional District who supports Trump, said he spoke with Reynolds briefly a few days after she endorsed DeSantis, telling her he harbored no ill feelings for her decision. "Because you pick a different flavor of ice cream to me, you're still my governor, and you've still been a good governor," he said. "I don't have any animosity. Obviously, do I wish that she would have picked President Trump? Yeah." As for the effects of Reynolds' endorsement on the caucus campaign, the Trump supporters said they don't think it will do much in pulling away support from the former president. "I'm sure that Governor Reynolds will impact some people," Loeffler said. "The feedback I've seen is maybe 2 or 3 points at the most." Dykstra said he did not think the endorsement would have much impact on the race, saying the community-based nature of the caucuses has more of an impact than endorsements. "When people gather together in their communities and have a good discussion on who they support and why they support them, and there's any amount of reasoning that takes place, I think people come together and make a good decision," he said. And our next statewide headline reads, RNC and Iowa Christian Group reach agreement on candidate forum. The Republican National Committee will allow presidential candidates to attend the Family Leaders Thanksgiving Forum, backing away from its prior warning to candidates that participating in the event could lead to disqualification from future debates. The RNC and the Family Leader have reportedly agreed on the format for the Christian Conservative Organization's November 17th forum. The Family Leader Foundation invited the top 5 major Republican presidential candidates to its Thanksgiving Family Forum in Des Moines. The RNC initially said the proposed format constituted an unsanctioned debate, and in a letter first reported by Real Clear Politics, warned their campaigns that attendance at the Family Leader event could disqualify them from future debates. RNC rules prohibit candidates from attending any debate that is not organized by the party. Bob Vanderplaats, president and CEO of the Family Leader, over the weekend posted to social media site X, formerly known as Twitter, that he and the RNC came to an agreement on the forum. "The RNC and I have agreed on the format of the Family Leader November 17th Thanksgiving Family Forum. The forum is not a debate. Thus, the RNC is giving a thumbs up for candidates to participate. Thanks to the RNC for facilitating a win-win for the process. Choose Well 24, Vanderplaats posted Saturday. Family Leader spokesperson Drew Zahn said in an email the RNC has relented on its previous position and agreed to the format of the forum as planned. Five Republican candidates, former President Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott, and Ohio biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy were invited to the forum. Zahn said three of the five candidates, DeSantis, Scott, and Ramaswamy, had confirmed plans to attend. Scott, however, has since dropped out of the race. He said that Trump is unlikely to accept and said the group expects to announce Haley's confirmation shortly. We expect to have three candidates on stage around the table at the same time for a civil and insightful conversation moderated by Bob Vanderplaats, Zahn said. An RNC spokesperson on Monday confirmed it is okay with candidates attending the Family Leader Forum. Vanderplaats said on Fox News last week that he may consider endorsing a candidate after the forum. While he has not publicly endorsed a candidate so far, he has been critical of Trump. After we have that conversation with the candidates, our board, my team, and myself will just get a chance to discern if this is the time for us to weigh in or not, he said. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 14th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and make it a great Tuesday.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Zofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.